step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to Pod on the Tyne, your stranded in a football hinterland podcast dedicated to Newcastle United from The Athletic FC. I'm Taylor Payne, and this is our first ever summertime pod. I've choked on my own breath. How do you do that?
Yeah, Chuck, you're so excited about this being our first ever summertime pod.
I'm going to do that again.
Yeah, you should.
I'm Taylor Payne, and this is our first ever summertime pod. We've got Chris Woff with us and George Corton. Chris, how are you today? Resplendent in Jamaica football shirt.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, I'm just, you know, summertime has arrived on Tyneside. The sun is shining outside. And I'm sat in this room talking to you guys. So, yeah, very much celebrating summer.
Trapped indoors. George Corcoran, how are you?
Yes, I'm okay. No praise of my shirt, I notice. I'm wearing a very checky, it's a tablecloth, effectively, in shirt form. But I like to do that.
Woody from Toy Story. That's what it kind of,
it is a bit like that
sort of thing for me.
I feel like if you wear a tablecloth as a shirt, then in the Chris scenario where you spill lasagna all over your own crotch, it wouldn't be so noticeable in this scenario, would it?
Absolutely not. Right then, chaps. Fun and games in early July already, isn't there? We're going to be talking about transfers.
It's June. You fast forwarded a month.
So, chaps, fun and games in early June already. We're going to be talking about transfers. I'm sure everybody wants to hear about that. The transfer window, the mini window, slammed shut on the 10th of June. Newcastle haven't failed to sign a single player, missed out on their main target and right forward to a pitiful Manchester United. There's narrative in some quarters, George, isn't there? But what's the reality here?
I've just now that you've said that, it feels like the transfer window is constantly evolving just in order to sort of take the piss out of Newcastle United. So like this time last year, we had the June 30th deadline, which nobody had kind of really considered until it got close, that, you know, that obviously Newcastle had to scramble around to raise money for. Now it feels like we've just had this super special extra early transfer window just to make Newcastle fans really aggressive.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It's less of a transfer window. It's more of like a, you know, them beads that used to hang down in front of a kitchen that your nana had. It's kind of a transfer, one of them.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. Obviously, it's all designed around the club World Cup. This little mini window is very, very weird. I mean, so the reality is that it is early to mid-June and, you know, the transfer window stretches until September the 1st. So we do have quite a long way to go. You know, the other side of that coin is that Eddie Howe had talked after the last game of the season about being ready to act quickly, that he'd, you know, given this message internally, repeatedly, and Newcastle haven't acted quickly, certainly in terms of this first 10 days or so. The other bit is that we have a sporting director who is on the way out at the end of this month. We have a chief executive who is on the way out. So on the one hand, it's very, very early days and people should chill out a bit. On the other hand, there is this slight fog Is it fog? Is it a mist? Is it just a bit of cloud? There was a slight mist of uncertainty around the club again. A fret, a sea fret.
Yeah.
And we are fretting. Yeah. We're fretting with it. So I think that's how it is. And, you know, what we don't want to see is a second consecutive summer window where uncertainty is allowed to sort of take root at the club in the dressing room. Definitely did 12 months ago. And people are holding their breath a little bit about what might happen this time.
And just to make it completely clear, Chris Woff, this is all your fault, isn't it, if you would believe the responses to your deal sheet on Twitter. This is all you're doing. You know nothing. You are a charlatan and a fraud. What do you say to those accusations?
Some of the nicest things anyone's ever said about me, I think. yeah, I mean, just to, yeah, there has been frustration. And I get the frustration. People see Man City doing what looks like very good business early on, Liverpool doing some significant deals, Manchester United signing Matias Cunha, and then seemingly Brian Mbeumo, who was Newcastle's first-choice right-wing target, suggesting a preference that he wants to go to Manchester United. Now, that deal's not done yet, but that seems as if Newcastle are quote-unquote missing out on players. They're in for Liam Delap as well. Maybe he's not to the same extent, but they liked Liam Delap. He's gone to Chelsea. They really liked Dean Huijsen and put through their hat in the ring for that, knowing it was highly unlikely. Similar, I suppose, to Michael Olise last summer when he ended up going to Bayern Munich and Huijsen goes to Real Madrid. So Newcastle have tried to make early moves. It hasn't happened, but we are speaking here on June the 10th. There is this first mini window. The majority of the deals that have been done so far have been done via release clauses. Release clauses are far easier to do. There's terms which have to be met. You can then go and reach those deals, and all you need to do is agree personal terms with a player. Then you've got clubs at the Club World Cup who need players in early, or you have Liverpool, who are probably the exception to the rule, but they also are Premier League champions and don't seem to have PSR issues there. When we go to the fact that today is June the 11th, I've just looked back, and if you discount last summer, when obviously it was PSR dominated for Newcastle, in the summer of 2022, Nick Pope was Newcastle's first signing beyond Matt Target's loan being made permanent. He arrived on June the 23rd. Sandro Tonali was the following year, and that was July the 3rd. So it's very rare that deals do go through this early. The market is still stabilising. Prices will come down. Newcastle, I think, at the minute, a lot of fees have been inflated. I get the frustration out there. I do understand it. And there has been some internal frustration in the fact that Newcastle maybe haven't moved swiftly enough or haven't got stuff done. But the fact that the season finished 2.5 weeks ago, I think, says everything, really. And if we're talking in this same way in a month's time, when Newcastle are just about to fly to Austria for the pre-season training camp, completely fair enough. How once one, if not two, players in by pre-season training beginning on July the 7th? If you're in that position then, that's entirely understandable. Then you will start to be growing concerned. But I think at this stage, it's more frustration rather than anything else, and I certainly wouldn't panic.
Andy, Jay Garland, Blue Sky, asked, will we ever sign a first-team player again, George?
Well, it's a... Okay, I mean, so yes, it's June the 10th. However, this is a reference to the fact
it's June the 11th today.
You're a little So, firstly, it is June the 11th, so, you know, that's one thing to say to Andy. But the other point that I'm sure he's referring back to here is that we're now in the fourth transfer window in succession, where Newcastle are yet to sign a first-team-ready player. That's that's the fact of life. We know the reasons that players haven't been brought in previously. It's been a PSR issue mainly, and so it does feel like Newcastle aren't signing anybody. But I mean, I can answer that question. Yes, they will. They'll sign a first team player this summer, and more besides. But I don't think that's an outrageous subject to make. But that's important context that Eddie Howe. And the team's achievement last season was astonishing when you say that they've not been strengthened for three windows at that point, that motivation and competition has all had to be self-produced. It's been internal, the way they've done that. His squad got smaller in January. They had a good season, a really good season in terms of injuries by and large, but that puts that achievement into context. He is in desperate need of help, of reinforcements. He's more than earned it. And, you know, that competition, that injection of quality is really, really important to help everybody go again. Newcastle have got some excellent players. They've got an excellent team. They've shown that categorically last season. They need help now.
Somebody called Kraftwerk has messaged in saying, with transfer rumour silly season in full effect, Have you ever been tricked or duped by those with a vested interest in writing about transfer fake news? Chris, how about you?
I can't remember a specific example, but it is something which is, yeah, it is basically a collateral damage that you have within this industry. It's not quite as bad as sort of takeover sagas and the like, but it is always a frustration because you speak to different people supposedly involved in the deal and you can get almost completely different answers. So, no specific example springs to mind, but there definitely have been some over the years where I've written things and it hasn't in time proven to be as accurate as I would have liked it to be at that moment, certainly early on in my career. But I think George has a story he wants to relay.
Well, there's a couple of things that have kind of sprung to my mind. I mean, there are times you talk to contacts and, you know, if you work in the media, sometimes you're used. I mean, yeah, sometimes, you know, sometimes it's happened. Now, sometimes it, you know, with some people, it happens with your full knowledge. It's like, you know, that sometimes you can lay a false trail. You might be used to do that. So, oh, yeah, you know, we're interested in Cristiano Ronaldo, but actually you're trying to sign James Perch. You know, you can put, you know, there's this idea that the media can lay a, you know, a false trail sort of thing. And that does happen. I mean, that happens quite a lot. Agents can do that, but people employed by clubs can do it. I mean, I can think of a funny example. I don't think there's any harm in mentioning his name, but when Steve Bruce was Sunderland manager, he'd always be happy to chat off the record, and you would say to him, look, you know, off the record, Steve, you've been linked with, you know, blah, 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 someone at X club. And he kind of loved chatting that sort of, I called it Brucey's transfer bingo. And he would like say, yeah, like him, really like him. And then, you know, you'd go away and write a story. And then the next press conference, he would be asked, oh, you've been linked with player X. And he would say, yeah, I don't know where that's come from. It's absolutely load of nonsense. It's like, And so that kind of thing can happen. But I've got a slightly different story, which was that when I was at the Times for a little while, we did a sort of daily update on every single Premier League team. And so, you know, my job would be Newcastle, Sunderland, Middlesbrough when they're in the Premier League. And sometimes it was really quite difficult to find a newsy update. Anyway, I'm not going to name the person who did it, but Liverpool were linked with Didier Baptiste, and his name had floated in a couple of publications before the Times did it, but we did it. And unfortunately, Didier Baptiste was a character in Dream Team, the Sky soap opera.
Harchester United. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I'm interested, has it changed much over the years, George, the way the transfer windows and stuff work and the information that you're given? Obviously, a lot of it's very agent-driven now, isn't it? And you know, like you say, there'll be stories getting put out there to kind of smoke screen or to throw people off guard or send them down certain avenues. Has that changed in the numerous years that you've been covering club?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's more the same thing. I mean, it's about relationships. Journalists, you know, speak to agents, they speak to managers, they speak to players sometimes, they speak to directors. And I mean, I've relayed the story millions of times about how you can speak to all those people at the same club and get three different answers about who, you know, about a certain player, because the manager might have an agenda, the agent might have an agenda, you know, the director may have a different way of looking at it, and putting it all those things together can be quite difficult and confusing. But no, I mean, we live in a completely different media landscape, and landscape full stop, when players and agents and clubs can all speak to fans directly if they wish to. But the media can still be useful at getting stories out, or get, you know, stories out that can't come through official channels. And it's all about, you know, putting pressure on, or, you know, alerting people, sometimes hoodwinking people. I think that still happens.
There's an exiled Geordie in Essex called Gaz who's asked, are there any particular things that listeners should look out for to sort the truth from the nonsense when it comes to transfer rumours, Chris?
Can I jump in here, Taylor? Because I actually am going to be nice about Chris, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that I absolutely adore him. The second thing is that I hugely respect Chris as a journalist and someone who has really come into his own at Newcastle, covering Newcastle for The Athletic. You won't find a better connected journalist than Chris. That will embarrass him, but it is true. And so if you want to know what's actually happening and or happened, I would still say you go to the traditional media outlets, because it's those people who have the time, the resources, and, you know, the desire to sort of actually get to know people and find out what's happening. Chris knows what's happening at Newcastle, or in this case, at the moment, what's not happening.
Yeah.
So that is a compliment, but it's absolutely based on fact. I'm really proud of Chris. I wouldn't just say that. So if that embarrasses him, I don't care.
It does embarrass me, but thank you. That's very, very kind. Just to add briefly on that as well, and this is going to sound a bit as if it's like, oh, you know, all UK outlets are better, and this isn't how I mean by it, but every single window, certainly with Newcastle United, particularly post-takeover, there are links. There always seems to be links in Turkey with lots of players supposedly moving in and out. There's been a link over the last couple of days from, I think it was a Ghanaian outlet, suggested Newcastle were close to sign a player called Nordi Mukwueli. And I think I would take any story which emerges elsewhere with a slight pinch of salt. It may turn out that actually they have got it originally and some of those stories are true. And that's not me having to go at them on the basis of it. But it's also easier, I think, with that separation that Newcastle could be linked as a club who supposedly are close, because maybe there's been a conversation somewhere along the line, or if you get Newcastle's name linked with a club, then that means that their player it creates a market for the player and the like. So I think if stories emerge in unusual areas, I suppose, or somewhere which is not directly connected to Newcastle United, really, when things start to heat up, I think you will get that the journalists who cover the club day to day will more likely be reporting. And that's when, and as I say, it may be that they have been beaten to the scoop initially, but I think that I would be circumspect about links emerging elsewhere before they have any name put to them in terms of someone in this sort of area who covers the club day to day, maybe.
Fair play. Gaz has also suggested that Chris have a look out for Sylvester Stallone's Mizza recipe, which is a meat pizza where even the base is made out of mint. Or, as Chris likes to call it, a snack.
It sounds very much like the what I had from Acropolis before all of the Greek variety, in terms of the it was actually a meat wrap. The wrap itself was made out of mince before. That was the day of the parade, actually, the Carabao Cup parade. So
when I was in Boston last year, there was a restaurant there that had something called a meat tornado, which I thought was quite astonishing.
Chris, just out of interest, when you go to the toilet, do you piss gravy?
Right, let's move on. Specifically on Brian Mbeumo, who is still a Brentford player, as Chris said earlier on at the time of recording this show. He has been a rumoured target for the club for quite some time for obvious reasons. Is there any concerns, Chris, that we didn't get him or indeed go for him?
There's a concern in the sense that, as I said before, he was the top right-winger target. He was the one who eventually they'd identified. They watched him for a long period of time. Lots of senior figures were at St. James's in the recruitment department for the Brentford game at home, and lots of them watched him, and they've discussed for a while the potentials of what he would bring. I mean, you just have to look at his raw numbers in the Premier League. Assists and goals, certainly over the last couple of seasons, have been very, very impressive. So the fact that Newcastle thought he would be the answer, Eddie Howe certainly thought he'd be an answer, and that they look unlikely to sign him, that is a concern. But it's the reason why they aren't moving from here is that he has suggested a preference for Manchester United, but also that all the suggestions at this end are basically that financially it's just a deal Newcastle couldn't and wouldn't do. So wages wise it would have potentially broken their wage structure. That is all the suggestions we're getting. Also, fee wise you're probably talking north of 50 million now. They probably would have committed about 50 million to him, but I don't think they would have gone much higher than that. Brentford have the option of exercising the 12 months he already has, another 12 months on top of that, so 2 years left in his contract. They are very good at asking for high fees for their players and getting them, because they don't need to sell per se. So I think from a financial perspective, in some ways it sort of makes sense. Now, the concern is that Newcastle missed out on their top target, and now it's almost like a reevaluation. Newcastle had other attacking options they were looking at, and now they're sort of deciding where they go in the future in terms of this summer. Do they go still for an out-and-out right-winger target? Ideally, I think they would like one. They lost Miguel Almiron in January. They would like someone to compete with Jacob Murphy and really push him for that right-wing spot. But they also would like a versatile attacker. Can they afford to do both? Someone like in this sort of João Pedro role? I think that's sort of to be determined, and it sort of depends on fees going forward. So they're still like Anthony Elanga at Nottingham Forest, who they inquired about last summer. Mahadou Koudous has been floated at West Ham. I don't think that one's likely, but he's another name out there. They really like Antoine Semenyo at Bournemouth, but again, the price is very, very high. So I think it just depends which direction Newcastle end up going forward, and they haven't just maybe the blueprint they had going into the summer, as is so often the case at every single club, a transfer window never goes exactly how you expect it to, is just being rejigged at the moment, and Newcastle have to see what is actually possible in terms of who they can get in and how much they can strengthen.
Alan of the North as well has messaged in and said, why is a club that successfully signed Isak, Guimaraes and Tonali now so dead set on Premier League additions, only then to complain when these are too expensive? George, Eddie Howe has got a bit of a habit of going for tried and tested Premier League players, hasn't he?
So there's a couple of things that I'd like to say about this, and one kind of links back to Mbeumo. At the moment, Newcastle just aren't in a position to be able to compete financially with even a flailing Manchester United in terms of wages and also to a certain extent in terms of fees. So, and yeah, as Chris has already alluded to, you can make a similar argument about Chelsea and Dalap and others. So then you get to the follow-up question is, okay, so why therefore are these players so high up Newcastle's list of priorities? And that's a good, you know, that's a good and interesting question. It's something worth considering. If Brian Mbeumo, somebody who has scored 20 goals in the Premier League, he's not a secret to anybody, not in the same way that, you know, arguably Guimaraes was. You can make the same sort of point about Sven Botman, players that the big clubs have looked at and certainly considered, but haven't yet acted upon. And, you know, with the Tonali one, for example, Newcastle did that deal very, very secretly, on the quiet. We talked a bit earlier about smoke screens elsewhere. There was a bit of that going on, and they got him under the noses of other teams.
It is an interesting dynamic, this one, and Eddie Howe's record at Bournemouth was that he tended to sign quite a lot of UK-based players. The difference there, I suppose, is that Bournemouth are not Newcastle United in the sense that just having that reach externally and being able to attract the very best European players, theoretically. At Newcastle, there has also been a stream of Premier League experienced players have been signed, but the most expensive players who Newcastle have actually signed largely have come from abroad. And Newcastle are continuing to explore that market. Now, interestingly, the suggestion from at least some figures at the club is that at the moment, the easy narrative for supporters is, well, you're getting quoted these silly fees from Premier League clubs for players, why don't you go abroad? And actually, their suggestion is that the market is just as distorted, if not more so, in Europe, and that you look at someone like Hugo Ekitike, who Newcastle tried to sign exactly in the January of 2022. Now, he looks potentially like he's going to move this summer. It looks like the package that is wanted is up to around 100 million euros for him. Now,
that's an insane money, that.
He is a very good player, and he could become a very good player in the Premier League, but you could sign a player like João Pedro. Now, they don't know the exact asking price for him, potentially somewhere between 50 and 70 million. He is proven in the Premier League. He has that experience, and so it's sort of, you have the balance there of, do you pay maybe what is more than you think a player is worth in the Premier League, but they've actually done that already, or do you play what you think is an inflated fee for a player from abroad, and therefore they come in and it may work out really well, it may not. Now, they did pay more for someone like Alexander Isak. They thought they got a very good deal for Sandro Tonali. It's a balancing act, yeah. And I think that's partly at least why these players are being targeted. Newcastle need players who are going to come in and immediately make an impact. They can't have another window where certainly the two players you think might slot into the starting 11 potentially at right-sided centre-back and right-sided forward are development players. They may sign a couple of players like that. They may sign equivalents of Chino Livramento and Lewis Hall of 2 years ago, who were thought that they could perform immediately but really were seen for the long term, and then two senior sort of players coming in. That's what we expect them to do, and that may mean that they are more Premier League based than they are from abroad. But it isn't that Newcastle have shut off that market. I know the narrative's out there, and it's also an easy narrative to make, but actually the market is a bit distorted generally at the moment.
There's connected points to that is that, you know, Eddie Howe led those signings of whether it's Tonali and Isak, once they'd been put to him in the same way as, you know, Premier League signings would be put to him. He absolutely drove those signings forward. He wanted them as much as anybody at the club. There is this sort of strange sniffiness almost about players who've played in the Premier League or have come from Premier League sides, and I don't understand that at all, because Newcastle's hit rate in the transfer market is phenomenal. I mean, it compares with any club. I would say that their hit rate, it's 90%, it's 95%, and even the ones that you would argue weren't great value for money, whether it was Chris Wood, whether it was Matt Target, for example, have did what they needed to do for the club.
Yeah,
that they served a purpose. And, you know, you go through those players, either, you know, someone like Kieran Trippier, admittedly signed from Atletico Madrid, but a Premier League player, to Dan Burn, to the, you know, to the other players who've come on. Yeah, more recently, Livramento and Lewis Hall. At the time, we were kind of asking, you know, why have the club done that business now? But 2 years on, less than 2 years on, those players are absolutely fundamental to the team, to what, you know, to where the team wants to get to, but all, you know, already where it is. Yeah, Lloyd Kelly didn't pull up any trees, but he arrived on a free and was sold for a big profit. Pretty much, you know, pretty much everybody else has been successful. I mean, look at the team. Look at the team now. Anthony Gordon, Harvey Barnes came good last season. They've all been really good. Do you pay a premium for Premier League players? Yeah, traditionally you have. Chris has talked about the context. Context there now, but the point is that as a elite team, which is where Newcastle are in terms of winning a trophy and being in the Champions League, they're not an elite club yet, but as an elite team, to get better is actually really difficult. And Howe has said this himself countless times. You're talking about a small pool of players. But I would just defend what they've done in the transfer market with the last breath of my body, because I think what they've done is phenomenal. So I think he deserves a bit more respect.
And also, if anybody is interested, there's a good explainer from the Athletic's Man United team on the site about how and why they still have plenty of money to spend, even with PSR rumbling around in the background. PSR, we're bored. PSR.
Yeah. That's good.
That was Ollie's idea, though.
I'd eat orchid.
Sanj has asked, is the perceived lack of movement on transfers due to the club waiting for the PSR reset at the end of the month, Chris? And also he's asked, what's your opinion on chicken sausages?
In terms of chicken sausages, I'm not entirely against them, although I do prefer just, you know, separate chicken to be chicken and then sausages to be...
I don't know why you would choose a chicken sausage over a pork sausage, to be honest. It makes no sense.
Yeah, exactly. I very much like chicken, but not a separate... Anyway.
One thing I wish that sort of like free-range or organic chicken was available more readily in mince form, because I would like to make like chicken meatballs and things like that every now and again.
So, yeah, we're getting sidetracked here, but anyway,
we are.
In terms of PSR, the message from those inside the club is that if the right player is available at the right price before June the 30th, Newcastle can do that deal. They are able to move before then. Now, the reset at the end of the month, yes, it will give them some headroom, but they already created headroom in January with the sales of Lloyd Kelly, as George mentioned, and Miguel Almiron. So if they hadn't done that, they may have actually been needing to sell players. They aren't in that position now. But because of the way the PSR works... The fact it's amortized over the length of a contract, if Newcastle were to bring someone in now, that the actual cost to them in this current financial year wouldn't be that high, because it would be spread over the next few years. This year's nearly finished. So yes, theoretically they can sign players. They may end up signing, I think ideally they would like to sign a player or possibly two before the end of this month. That may be ambitious, but they are actually able to do that. So it's not the fact that they can't act, it's just they won't see, as they see it, overpay. Because the big message at the moment is it's sort of a financial prudence, in the sense that Newcastle don't want to leave themselves in the position they found themselves in over the last three windows, where they haven't been able to invest because of what they've done before. The reasons for that we all know about, and Newcastle needed to strengthen to get the stage out, but it also meant that they couldn't then strengthen in the subsequent windows. But also, going into a Champions League year, last time when Eddie Howe really needed help in the January, when Newcastle were going through an injury crisis, Newcastle financially couldn't actually support them. They want to be in a position next January, regardless of whether the squad is going through, hopefully, nowhere near the same injury crisis. They want to be able to strengthen both then and in future windows after that. And so it's not a case that they can't act, it's just they won't overpay.
There's an interesting dynamic here, and it's really about accounting. I mean, so it also, you know, it's not just about what Newcastle want, it's also about what the selling club might want. So if the selling club is having a similar position or close to their PSR limit, it might be in their interest to get a deal done before the end of this month, because that entire fee effectively goes straight into their, not into their bank balance, but for accounting purposes, it goes straight in. Whereas for Newcastle, as Chris said, it's paid off over years. So those are things that clubs have to then decide amongst themselves. There's nothing to stop also Newcastle from being in negotiation with the club now and for that deal not to become official until July the 1st when the new accounting period starts. So, I mean, PSR is an issue for everybody, whether you're selling, whether you're buying, whether you're making your account this year look healthier, whether you're loading it onto next year's. All this depends on what your three-year cycle looks like. I mean, it's hellishly complicated.
Ronnie Kungalesi has said, this is an interesting question, this, because this is one that gets bandied around in every single window without fail, and you will see stories which say Newcastle have X amount of pounds to spend in this transfer window. And he has asked, how much can we spend in this window? And it's such a strange and sort of weird concept, this, isn't it? That there's a, you know, the war chest. Whose chest?
Yeah, war chest. It is war chest. It's always wrong. And it I think in times past, it would be a reasonable question and you could perhaps have a decent stab at an answer. It's so much more complicated now. You know, it's dependent on selling as well as buying. It's dependent on PSR, what wiggle room you have. You could have £200 million in the bank to spend, but not be able to spend it because of what you've done over previous windows and previous summers. And, you know, Newcastle were trying to buy Mark Gahey last summer for what looked like a pretty hefty fee, not as much as Crystal Palace were perhaps suggesting as that went on. And then they didn't do business in January, citing PSR concerns, and actually sold players. So these things are not, you know, like, they're not straightforward. So, I mean, I can't even give a ballpark. I can't even give a ballpark figure there. And I don't even think it's particularly helpful. I don't know if Chris wants to add to that.
Yeah, I don't think it's particularly helpful. You've explained it pretty well. And Eddie Howe gave quite a good answer. I don't know if it was about a year or a year and a half ago, where he basically said that. He said, budgets don't work like that anymore. It's previously, you might have been told as a manager you have X amount of money to spend, but you don't actually get it. This is X, the amount you've got to spend. Because it's also, without getting into the sort of weeds of it, just for example, you say you sign a player for £50 million over a five-year contract. When we talk about budget, what is the budget then? Is your budget £50 million then? Or is your budget the £10 million which would go down in this year's accounts for the amortised piece? So that's how the way the transfer fees have changed in that regard. It's also the way that the clubs tend to work out in terms of how much money they've got to commit. They also include agents' fees and they include wages as well. And so that muddies the water as well. What is your actual room in terms of Newcastle? Probably have more capacity to spend actual fees than they do on wages because they have a wage structure. Yeah. And so it may be that they turn down a deal not because, or don't progress with the deal, not because they couldn't afford both the fee and the agent's fees, but they couldn't afford the wages involved. And so the message to us at the moment is, rather than necessarily a specific budget, is that Newcastle probably can't do sort of two or three big players at £60 million. If they're to do deals this summer, they might be able to do sort of like one, possibly two, above that sort of £50 million mark, and then the rest of them, you're probably looking 20, 30, 40 million. I just don't think they can spend copious amounts in terms of if you take it on the whole, but that's all. They're all very roughshod figures there, really.
It's got to be situational as well, hasn't it, Chris? Because as we've heard loads of times in the past, if the right player becomes available at the right time for the right fee, then the club might go for it, you know?
Mark Gahey last summer is a perfect example. Newcastle weren't in a position really to spend a lot of money, but they would have done that deal if they could have got it at a price they wanted. But it would have been a knock-on effect if then they would have had to sell probably more players than they already did in the end.
And this is, you know, that takes us back. You know, it is PSR. I'm so sorry, but like Newcastle did do that immediately post takeover, and you can't knock the business they did, and or the reasons that they did it for. First window spent 92 million quid, whatever it was, more than any other club.
It had to happen, didn't it?
Had to happen. Newcastle, you know, were sinking like a stone. They did it. They stayed up. It was a success. The next summer, Callum Wilson gets injured, so they sign Alexander Isak, who has been an absolutely brilliant signing for Newcastle, double in value, you would say, or not far off. You know, one of the best strikers in Europe at the minute, if not the best. The following January, Anthony Gordon taking advantage of the situation Everton were in. They brought that forward from the summer. You look again at the summer, they saw a chance to get Livramento and Lewis Hall, hoping that they'd then boxed off their fullback positions for years to come. What happens at the end of that? Oh, there's no money to spend. oh, we've got to claw money back. We haven't sold. And so you've then had three windows without signing anybody for the first team. And so, yes, you can take advantage of situations. Yes, circumstances can change and force you to do things or encourage you to do things, but there will be repercussions somewhere down the line. And so we've seen the best of it and we've also seen the worst of it. Moving forward, as Chris said earlier, what they want to do is what they originally wanted to do, which was to allow themselves leeway to make signings if they need to do it in every window, including January.
Blue Jams asked, does Eddie Howe get personally involved in talking to transfer targets? And if so, at what stage to potentially help them, to help persuade them to join us? Chris, what do we know about this? How involved is Eddie Howe in the process?
He's very involved. I mean, the last year, obviously, there's been sort of, with Paul Mitchell's arrival and sort of almost the reshuffling of how things would work at the top. Newcastle then haven't signed any sort of first team 11 ready players, so therefore things change slightly. But really how it has worked and how it's likely to work this summer is that Eddie Howe does get involved towards he isn't in the identification process at the very start of it. He isn't there, but then the recruitment, there's actually an interview with a former scout who used to work with him in Bournemouth on YouTube, which you can watch, where he basically talks about how Eddie Howe as a manager basically does the job of a scout. Like he puts in the same diligence he does for every other aspect of his work, really. And so, but at the very early stages, his recruitment team sort of filter through what position he would say, this is what I'm looking for in terms of position, this is what I want that player to be able to do, and it would be filtered down to a certain number of players. Then he would be heavily involved in looking through those, and then when it eventually comes to this is the player that I want, he would at some stage be involved in that. Now, an example would be Sandro Tonali. Now, Sandro Tonali, one of the reasons Newcastle were able to convince him to come was Eddie Howe had a conversation with him, and rather than just go into a room and say, you know, I love you, Sandro, you're brilliant, I just want you to come in, he said that, but he also said, but I also think we can improve this part of your game. This is how I'm going to make you the best midfielder in Europe. This is what we're going to do. And so he's also honest. And that really was something which struck a chord with Sandro Tonali. And I think it has done with other players. So he is heavily involved. He likes to look a player in the eyes basically as well. And all of the reports he's had scouting wise and also sort of background check wise, he wants to do his own checks beyond that. And so, yes, he does reach out towards the end of it. Once they know this is the target they want, but he's very much part of the pitch.
You have to remember that officially people can't talk to footballers until deals have been agreed between clubs, and then you get permission to talk. There are still regulations in place, so clubs have to be careful. I wanted to briefly go back because it reminded me of this of the Mbeumo situation. The question, why didn't they go in for him? Why didn't they bid? And our information was the same, that ultimately Newcastle, you know, didn't make sort of huge official contact with Brentford, because by the time the window was open, Newcastle were already aware that Man United was his preference. They knew what the they knew what the wage demands would be, and they knew that they wouldn't be in the same ballpark. Now, how do they know that? Well, because there are discussions between agents and football clubs, and it, you know, that sort of stuff still absolutely makes sense for all concerned to do. I mean, yes, if it oversteps the mark, a selling club could get irritated or annoyed, or, you know, a player can have their heads turned. But in reality, clubs don't go into transfer negotiations cold. They don't just ring up a club and say, we want to buy this player. They do their homework. They try and find out about the player. They try to find out whether the player would be receptive to movement, and they do their homework. So ultimately, if they didn't pick up the phone to Brentford about Mbeumo, it's because they knew there was no point.
Jamie has asked, what has Howe learned from the previous Champions League campaign, and what role will that play in recruitment? A bonus question as well. He said, if Chris could describe Joe Linton as a cut of meat, which cut of meat would he be? Do you want to tackle the serious one first, Chris?
Yeah, I'll tackle the serious one first. It's a good question, and I think that actually, in retrospect, although throughout the Champions League campaign, that window was questioned quite a lot, particularly because of Lewis Hall's initial struggles and the fact that Harvey Barnes got injured and Sandro Tonali obviously got his long suspension. It looked like a disastrous window, but actually, 2 years on, that business, I think, is seen to be very good. And that's I think Newcastle will approach it in a similar sort of way. The belief was, if they got into the Champions League as opposed to one of the other European competitions, perversely, they may actually need fewer players, because the belief is that they need to what they like to do is bring in quality over quantity. And so it's bringing in certainly two, maybe three players who will either go straight into the starting 11 or really push those starting players. And then of the sort of four, five players they may sign this summer, probably half of them will be those sorts of somewhere between the age of 21 and 24, can really... are very good players in their own right already, potentially even elite, but can develop with the club and grow with them. And then two of the other players may be slightly younger, but who are seen as elite potential, but aren't quite there yet. And so that's, I suppose, in a strange sort of way, the learning from the Champions League last time is that actually, if you rationalise the situation, you take out the circumstances which actually unfolded, they believe that business was good and was the right sort of business. It was just unfortunate the way that things worked out. And so I suspect they are going to try and do something very similar this summer.
Yeah, I mean, idiots like me sort of said 2 years ago, it's like, well, you know, why are they going for fullback where you have Kieran Trippier, who, you know, absolutely brilliant, been sensational for Newcastle. And, you know, then obviously at left back, you had Dan Byrne, who was filling in, doing really well. You had Matt Target behind him. And it was like, that sort of doesn't make sense. Surely they should be getting a right winger. Surely, you know, those other positions or another forward. And, you know, the argument that the club gave at the time was that they saw the biggest drop off in those positions. That was the idea, that as soon as you had an injury in those positions,
yeah, it affected us. Yeah.
You were in trouble. And I think, you know, but I mean, to give us a bit of credit, we did make that point that sometimes you can't judge the effectiveness of a window until 12 months down the line, yeah, or 18 months down the line. And I think Chris is spot on. You look at that window very, very differently now. At the time, it felt like everything, yeah, was a disaster or wrong. Now it doesn't feel like that. I think that approach would be right this time. I mean, if you look at Newcastle's squad, the lesson would be that if there's an injury at right wing where Jacob Murphy is the only out-and-out right winger, Newcastle would be in trouble. You know, immediately you're putting square pegs in round holes. The same would probably apply to right centre-half. You've got Fabian Cher, who's been brilliant. Behind him, you've got Lascelles, who's been injured for a very long, long time. And is he an elite centre-half? I think that's a fair question after his kind of time out. So I think that would be one lesson. If you talk about other lessons, it's very difficult to draw because Newcastle were decimated by injuries. So, you know, in terms of that, I think it's very difficult to draw conclusions, except that having at least two good players in every position, whether it's the same players in some through being versatile, I think that's really important to have. The other lessons will be about travel, will be about preparation, will be about recovery, all of those things. That was, you know, that's not necessarily to do with recruitment, except that you do want robust players who can handle that load. I think Newcastle and Howe and his staff will be so much better for having gone through it once already.
So this is the ultimate question, Chris. Is there any progress?
Chris hasn't done meat. Joe Linton's meat.
Yeah, Chris, what cut of meat would Joe Linton be? These are the questions people really want to know the answer to. Never mind this transfer bullshit.
Clearly.
I think that I'd probably go for a rump steak in the sense that he's cooked correctly, he's exactly, yeah, pure meat.
Yeah, I think if cooked correctly, which in this instance would just be raw.
Veins and blood.
Raw steak.
Yes, I was thinking exactly the same thing, Chris, a rump steak. In fact, I was thinking specifically a picanha, which is a Brazilian rump cap cut. You know, if you don't get it right, it can be tough and horrible. But, you know, treated correctly and seasoned properly.
It's a thing of beauty.
It's an absolute thing of beauty, yeah.
Definitely. Of raw, aggressive beauty.
So the real question, Chris, at this point, any progress on actual transfers at this stage? James Trafford rumours seem to be the most prominent.
Actual transfer, I like that as a term.
Actual, yeah. As opposed to made-up fairy tale nonsense.
As to this bullshit that we've been talking about for 40 minutes.
Well, James Trafford is very much Newcastle's number one goalkeeper target. They do have interest in other players, or they've watched Lille's Lucas Chevalier. They did watch John Garcia at Espanyol, although he seems to be Barcelona bound. I mean, very much James Trafford is the player they want. They wanted him last summer and couldn't agree a fee, and then had PSR issues. Informal talks have sort of happened between the clubs and I think that there's people inside Newcastle who believe that James Trafford would like to come to them and did. I mean, he said something on a podcast recently, I think we're basically talking about, he didn't identify Newcastle specifically, but he said, I was heavily linked with the club last year and I felt that it was sort of the right move for me. It was exactly what I would need in my career, the sort of place that I want to be at. And so it's little secret that that was Newcastle and that they are still interested, but an agreement's not yet in place. Burnley obviously were promoted and James Trafford had a wonderful season, kept a record number of clean sheets, and so the asking price has gone up significantly in the course of last year. But Newcastle, again, like we said painstakingly, unfortunately, about various other targets across this podcast so far, Newcastle are adamant they won't overpay or won't blow too much of the budget. And I think optics-wise, it wouldn't necessarily be brilliant if the first player Newcastle signed was a goalkeeper, seeing as they've got five already and have already extended Mark Gillespie's contract by another year. John Ruddy's in talks and probably is going to extend for another year. That doesn't mean that Newcastle don't need a goalkeeper, or Eddie Howe doesn't believe they need a goalkeeper. He very much does, and I think that the likelihood is that Odysseus Vlachodimos will probably go out on loan, mainly because of PSR reasons. It'll be difficult to sell him because Newcastle would have to register a huge loss. That's quite convoluted way of explaining that basically I think they're going to be lumbered with Vlachodimos for a little while yet.
Yeah.
Dubravka probably will leave, and then that means that ideally they would like someone who really pushes Pope. They don't want to lose Nick Pope. So optics-wise, it wouldn't be great if he's the first signing, but as George said, you have to move wherever the market is at that time and whatever is available to be got at. So the short answer is Newcastle are not yet close to signing someone. The longer answer is that they are in talks about some players, including James Trafford, and there is hope that they can do that one.
Liam's actually asked, I'm going to drop this in now, even though it's a little bit further down the run order. Liam's asked, how many Newcastle United goalkeepers does it take to change a light bulb? I think the answer is about 8, isn't it? Something like that now, maybe up to. There's also been chat around Fraser Foster and Tim Krull as well, hasn't there?
Yeah, and they are both names who, my understanding is that they have been mentioned in sort of early recruitment discussions. I think the likelihood is the direction of travel at the moment is they're probably not going to pursue either of those, because partly that is to do with UEFA's homegrown quota being in the Champions League, which I've explained before, and both of those players would qualify as being club trained, which you're meant to have 4 senior players who are club trained. Now, Newcastle, the mood music at the moment seem to be that they think, regardless of Sean Longstaff's future, they will have both the capacity to have a squad which is capable of being in the Premier League and in the Champions League. And with that, it could be that some players may only be in one or the other if they can't register them in both. But also, the rules are far more complicated than this, and that there is a suggestion that Lewis Hall may even count as club-trained due to the number of months he's been in Newcastle, even though he wouldn't be have to register as a senior player. I don't fully understand the full ins and outs of it, but the suggestion, at least from inside the club, is that it's not actually as much of an issue as they feel. It probably will restrict them in terms of what they can name next year, but they aren't going to go and sign a goalkeeper for that solitary reason. If they keep John Ruddy, they're highly, highly unlikely to sign either of those two, given the number of goalkeepers they've got.
Kay Southern's also asked, if other clubs are in the same position we were in last June, will Newcastle United take advantage as Forest did and rip us off for a third-choice goalkeeper?
Well, I mean, again, it is worth revisiting this history a little bit. That when Elliot Anderson left, very much against the will of Eddie Howe, who foresaw him having a prominent role in the team, in the squad last season, Newcastle were obliged to take Odysseus Vlachodimos for a paper fee of £20 million, which is obviously, by far more than they've spent on a goalkeeper in the past. He wasn't anybody who was featured on their recruitment list. It was a position they were looking to strengthen in terms of James Trafford, but he wasn't somebody that they wanted or needed. They had no choice but to take him as part of those negotiations. I mean, it's astonishing, really, still, when you think about it. He made one substitute appearance against Wimbledon in the Carabao Cup. I mean, I feel sorry for him as a human being. But, Newcastle can't allow themselves to get into that position again. Could Newcastle do something similar to another team? Well, yes, if another team is close to their PSR limit like Newcastle were. I'm not aware that anybody is quite as desperate as that this time around. Chris might know differently. But yeah, I mean, they have been ready to act. But I mean, I think we have to just recall just how desperate and difficult things were for Newcastle. You know, that within 48 hours, effectively, of that deadline, they were talking internally about a double-figure points deduction. That's what they were looking at, and they did everything they could to avoid it. In that sense, they did well, but the Vlachodimos transfer was just bonkers.
Just very quickly on the sort of PSR situation, it's still fluid, and the thought in the market is that clubs aren't in the same position they were 12 months ago, but really, actually, it's probably the last fortnight in June, as we've told with Newcastle, yeah, that really, actually, suddenly panic sets in. If there's clubs, you look at Aston Villa's situation, you do wonder if they may need to sell, but the feeling, at least inside Newcastle, is that it's unlikely that certainly the volume of clubs there were last year who were needing to do deals, because clubs have had to rein in their spending in order to comply, really, going forward.
There's been a few bits and pieces of chat around Dominic Calvert-Lewin this week as well, Chris. Any noise around him?
The suggestion is that because he's going to be soon to be free agent, seemingly not going to, well, hasn't accepted Everton's current offer. Newcastle have looked at him in each of the last two summers, I think it is, also maybe two of the last three summers. Certainly last year, at one stage, he was potentially going to be involved in a deal for PSR, but the mood music at the moment, the direction travel is that he's not a player they're currently considering, though, despite him being a free agent.
Fair play. We've also seen this week Manchester City sniffing around Tino Livramento, Chris.
Yeah, supposedly they're very much like him. Newcastle are adamant he's going nowhere alongside Sandro Tonali, Alexander Isak, Anthony Gordon, Bruno Guimaraes. That they still have that bullish tone on these players, but Livramento is someone they invested in, they believed was going to grow with the club. He has very much impressed, obviously shown he can play at left back as well, arguably even more successfully than at right back, and yeah, they are determined that's not going to happen, and they haven't yet been tested in that regard.
And we've also got to say good luck to Tino in the Euro under 21 starting tomorrow, Thursday the 12th of June in Slovakia. Good luck, Tino, with that. Right then, let's have a quick break, chaps, and we'll come back and talk about Academy.
Come on, you Maggies.
So let's talk about transfer strategy more generally, chaps. Laurel on Blue Sky, buying childhood Newcastle supporters, Dan Byrne, Jacob Murphy, Lewis Hall, Amber Keegan-Stobbs as well, of course, has proven great business. Are there more players supporting the club that we could go for, except for maybe Elliot Anderson?
Yeah, good question. I mean, yeah, obviously Elliot Anderson would be the obvious one. Leif Davis at Ipswich as a left-back is a very strong Newcastle fan, but I don't think, well, A, Newcastle don't need a left-back necessarily, and I don't know if you'd necessarily say would he massively improve what they're doing at the moment. I don't necessarily know, not immediately sort of spring to mind. You sometimes see these unusual stories where a sort of prominent player across Europe has some sort of connection to Newcastle at some stage, but there isn't anyone who necessarily springs to mind. But at the same time, you could have said the same for Dan Byrne, maybe going into that January 2022 window. He's not necessarily someone would have gone, he's the player who's really going to improve them, and look where we are 3.5 years on. So
my favourite one of those is Antoine Griezmann, who was linked to Newcastle because he had been them on Football Manager for a few seasons running, and then posted a photo of him and Kylian Mbappe with Newcastle shirts on, all photoshopped up. I love stuff like that. That's the kind of thing I'm interested in the summer. Never mind, keep your deal sheets and keep your transfer rumours. That's what I want. Nonsense like that. We've got an exciting feature coming soonish. Timescale to be confirmed, on Newcastle's Academy, which will be both in-depth and also great. In the meantime, lots of questions about the chance of youngsters breaking into the first team squad, especially with the club competing on four fronts next season. A few have asked about Garang Kuol. He's found some form in the under-21s. Is he likely to depart?
Newcastle have to make a decision on this summer. My understanding is he's got a year left in his deal. I think that he did perform very well for the under-21s. He seems to have struck up a good relationship with Dermot O'Carroll, and who's got the most out of him. But I think he's now at a stage in terms of the time he's been at Newcastle that they're probably not going to loan next season and extend his contract. Maybe there isn't the value there, but they have to make the decision on that, whether they do that, because you can't really loan him out this year and then just let him go on a free next year. Do you try and find a buyer for him? And it may depend on interest out there, but I think that there's at least a reasonable chance that Gankwal, who is an Australian international, could well leave, and hopefully he still fulfills his potential elsewhere. It just hasn't quite worked out for him at Newcastle. Maybe the pathways weren't in place that they believe will be, hopefully be now, for the next player who you can ask me about in a second.
Yes, Cordero, the latest high-profile youth signing, Chris.
Yeah, so he's 18-year-old winger. He's signed from, or he will sign from Malaga on a free transfer on July the 1st. But he's not considered a first-team sign at this stage. He's going to immediately be sent out on loan, probably to somewhere in Europe, possibly, well, largely because of visa situation and the fact that it's complicated, but you get a certain number of exemptions post Brexit that you can give to certain players who don't automatically qualify for a work permit, and that can have complications down the line if they eventually are on your first team. It's convoluted, but basically partly for that, but also for his development. He isn't yet. He's been playing in the Segunda Division, the second division in Spain. He's done very well there. He's already played 60 matches at senior level despite only being 18, but he's very much still a development player. I'm going to be writing on him with my colleague Guillermo Rai about basically who he is and why Newcastle signed him over the course of the next week, so please look out for that.
Jake's asked as well, should we expect any other Cordero-type signings in this window?
I think, yes, definitely. This is part of the approach that the club have made since Dashworth was here, really, that they have to absolutely stock that level of player, that age group of player from abroad. I mean, the importance of that, I mean, you know, ideally you want players to come and push their way into the first team, but if they don't do that, then you sell them on at profit. Now, Jan Kuberminter is, you know, got Newcastle out of a £30 million shaped hole last summer. I mean, without that money, Newcastle would have been talking huge points deductions. So, you know, God forbid they go through that again. But this is how you get more money into your coffers. It's how you get bigger and stronger as a team. And as I said, ideally, Cordero will be coming into the first team reckoning at Newcastle in a year or 2 years. But if not, then he will be developed into an asset. That is really important.
Daniel's message in, would love to know what the club think of the academy progress and if any of the young stars are ready to feature in the first team games, even in the cups. Chris, we got anybody who's on the cusp of kind of breaking through into that first team?
Well, I've written about Sean Neave, and we've discussed him on this podcast, and also Leo Shahar, who both trained almost full-time, basically full-time from February onwards, once the January window had shut with the first team. You had Trevon Sanusi, who trained during the first half of the season before he got injured. He actually made his debut and won the cup competitions, I believe, as well. And that's the next step for them. So it's seen as a big pre-season for players like that, who they'll come back and probably be involved in some capacity with the first team in terms of maybe going to Austria, maybe even going to East Asia on the tour. And it's whether they can sort of grasp that chance. And the interesting dynamic Newcastle have this year is that rather than immediately send players out on loan for the first half of the season if they think they're ready for that or for that prospect of it, as would often be the case, because Newcastle are going to have qualified for the Champions League, they've also qualified for the UEFA Youth League.
Right.
And because Newcastle via under-21s via the league have also qualified for, it's another international cup, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it basically gives them more international games. The under-21s are actually going to have quite a lot of competitive matches or higher level than sort of Premier League 2 games, both in that and also the EFL Cup and then the National League Cup. So keeping those players around, and then the flip between the first team and maybe the under-21s for that play, and for the under-19s in the UEFA Youth League, these players can develop, and then it's about kicking on to be in the first team. Now, whether any of them can actually do that and be in the first team regularly, it's still a huge step up, but they are the names I'd say are closest to really being like. There are others who are sort of in and around, who've trained a little bit, but they're the three who have been very close in terms of training regularly with the first team over the course of last year.
In terms of the kind of academy more broadly, yeah, absolutely. Our understanding is that the club are very happy with what's happening there. I think the biggest indication of that is that Steve Harper has really been empowered by both Dan Ashworth and Paul Mitchell to grow the academy. It hasn't been ripped up. It hasn't been torn apart and started again. It's been improved, and he's been given resource to bring in more staff to help with facilities. It's looking really good. The building's absolutely at full capacity. It's full of really good elite staff. It still has that family atmosphere to it. You know, they are a long way behind the biggest clubs still. You know, those clubs have got 5-10 year head start on them, but it's full of really passionate, skilled people. And you know, hopefully when we do our big feature on the academy, you'll get to kind of hear a bit more about the identity of the place. But is this important? Yeah, of course it's really important. I talked about Jan Kuberminter a minute ago, but also Elliot Anderson. You know, that got Newcastle out of a £30 million shaped hole last summer too. And if you look at the calibre calibre of the people who have driven forward into the first team. You've got Elliot Anderson, a £30 million footballer, not still playing in the Premier League. You've got Lewis Miley, who had a tougher time last season, both with injury and then forcing his way into an absolutely world-class midfield. But that is a really good hit rate for a Premier League team to have people of those calibre come forward and push into the team. That's really good. Those are just the big names that we see. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of really, really good work being done by some very, very committed, high level people.
And speaking of behind the scenes, and technically everything we've talked about so far is behind the scenes, isn't it? But what's happening in the back office, to borrow an Americanism? Paul Mitchell and Darren Eales are to depart, as we've already said. What's the progress, Chris, on recruiting replacements for those?
I remember seeing that term for the first time when we started working for The Athletic, someone replying in a Q&A and talking about back office staff, and I genuinely thought that meant like sort of someone who works in the ticket office or something like that. I had to look up what that term, yeah, the term meant. It's just interesting when you have these different scenarios between them. Well, yeah, so Paul Mitchell is due to leave on June the 30th. That came as a bit of a surprise in terms of to some people inside the club in terms of how swiftly that's happening, but he is working out his notice as things stand. Newcastle have already started the recruitment process, and that they have an external firm who are sort of contacting potential successors and also sort of sourcing out who may be available. A few names have already sort of leaked out there, but that still largely seems to be at a fairly early stage. And also what we've said on the previous podcast, do you want a sporting director before the new CEO? It would be the backwards way of doing it, but it may be how they're doing. And do they actually want a sporting director in the same capacity as Paul Mitchell, or is there going to be a restructure? We still don't know the answer to that question. There is still uncertainty around that, and that's what's not ideal. The CEO wise, Darren Eales is serving out his notice. There is still no confirmed public leaving date for him, despite the fact that we know he unfortunately has blood cancer and needs to receive treatment for that at some stage. Now Newcastle are very far on really with that, which you'd like to think they would be after 8 months in terms of finding his successor. And David Hopkinson's the former head of global partnerships at Real Madrid, is a leading candidate. That was reported elsewhere, and we can confirm he is a leading candidate. I think they're down to just the final few, but he's seen by some as potentially being the answer to it, but an appointment hasn't yet been made. Now, the suggestion is that after June the 30th, when Paul Mitchell leaves, then Darren Eales will likely assume a fair few of the responsibilities that maybe he had before Paul Mitchell came in, post Dan Ashworth. And then you have Eddie Howe, who's obviously heavily involved in transfers. You have Steve Nixon, the head of recruitment. You have Andy Howe, the deputy head of recruitment. And the two of them alongside Eales and Howe will work together and work on deals, and it'll sort of be a collaborative approach. Now, that seems to be something which they're comfortable with internally. It does feel rather opaque. It feels far from ideal, and it is a bit woolly in terms of all the explanations you get at the moment as to exactly how things are going to move on going forward. But the short answer is Newcastle are still searching in both those departments. And even if they get, the CEO they want or the sporting director they want, there may be a period of notice, so it may not even be that they come in immediately. You'd like to think that they could, but that may take some negotiating as well. So it's sort of still up a bit in the air, really.
We've had lots of questions on this as well, as you would expect, and I think Chris has covered most of them pretty well there, so I'm not going to go through them all. We do have a question from Rod Doug about the stadium, however. Was the rumoured 63,000 stadium plan a few months ago just the club assess an opinion on whether that was big enough and worth moving? Do they actually have a plan going forward? Who was financing it? And when on earth will we actually see their plan?
I'm going to let Chris take over some of that. But I mean, this is the interesting thing talking about, I mean, not so much a sporting director, but certainly a CEO. Because although the club are talking about it being business as usual, when you've got something like a new stadium or a rebuilt stadium on the agenda, that can't be business as usual. I mean, can or could Darren Eales say, okay, this is what we're going to do as a, you know, with a new stadium, and then step down 2 weeks later? And then,
yeah,
you know, what would be the biggest thing on the desk of a new CEO coming in? Well, there's nothing bigger than that, absolutely nothing. And so this to me is a concern. If you're talking about, you know, drift, if you want, on transfers, if you're talking about drift on stadium, if you're talking about drift on, well, I don't see how this situation helps any of that. In terms of transfers, the first signing does at least show that the club is able to operate. You know, and I think the first signing in those terms will calm people down. Okay, yeah, there is this flux, but they can do stuff. This kind of stuff does concern me, though, because there has already been a long wait to get to this point with the stadium. We were told it was imminent a year ago, and then kind of moving forward, I get it's a big decision. I get that they have these big options, and pressing the button on it is really important. Who is financing it remains a great question. And when do we get to see their plans? I mean, When do we see their plans? Well, you know, it's been moving towards something happening towards the end of this month. Perhaps that'll still happen. But as I say, if you're the new CEO, the first thing you want to do is to review big plans like this, just as if you're the new sporting director.
Of course,
you'd want to know what the plan for the transfer window is this summer. You know, you want to talk about how the team plays, all of those things, identity, the identity of the club. All of these things are tied together, and not having those positions in place doesn't feel helpful.
Just very briefly on the sort of questions that are answered there, there have been more reports that we could find out at some point this month or at some point this summer. The direction of travel was meant to be early 2025, was the actual publicly made message from the club, and they've obviously met that. I think you struggle to say that June is early 2025, so they're already beyond that stage. The uncertainty at the top certainly can't be helping that in terms of these big decisions being made. Were the plans definitive? My understanding is, certainly the insistence from people inside the club is that no, it wasn't. They hadn't yet finalised exactly what the capacity was going to be, even necessarily exactly where it would be and where they would move on to Leasers Park and the like. But we still don't know yet. Are they going to present one option? Is it going to be, this is what we think we should do, or this is what we want to do? Or is it going to be a couple of options? This is what happens if we stay at St. James's Park. This is what we happen if we move stadium. We're still unclear as to even what the announcement will be when it comes. And I don't want to feign superior knowledge of that than I actually have. That is the situation right now. There have been discussions with key stakeholders. They are presenting internally some options and the like, but what it'll actually be when they publicly come and say what they are going to do and when exactly that will be, I'm not going to pretend that I know that answer right now.
Well, fair enough. We've got a couple of questions to get through here. Toon Crazy 9, are the club ready to pounce instantly on things like related party sponsorships when Man City win APT2? Chris, this is right in your wheelhouse, this, isn't it?
Yeah, again, I haven't got a definitive answer, though, and I don't. Newcastle certainly wouldn't comment on that situation if you were to put it to them. I mean, it was interesting that when Darren Eales last week spoke to him after the account was published in February, I think it was, that rather than previously when Newcastle sort of distanced themselves from any of that, he did admit that Newcastle had a sort of watching brief, essentially, over what is happening there and to see what happens going forward. And Newcastle, if they are really going to expand revenues, then maybe they do need to do something like that. But I can't say whether they are ready to pounce instantly or not. I don't know the answer to that either.
Just on that, again, it's worth going back to immediately after the takeover when Amanda Staveley and Mehrdad Gudusi talked very openly about not having this big number, this big raft of Saudi companies ready to do, in their words, dodgy deals for APT stuff. Now, the rules were changed to stop Newcastle being able to do so much of that anyway, but they referenced a company like Saudi Airlines. There was nothing like that. Wait, now, when the takeover happened, it happened at pretty short notice after all that limbo, but there never seems to have been this market where they have got big Saudi companies ready to do deals which just involves shifting a load of money to Newcastle. I mean, A, you can't do that anymore, and B, there doesn't seem to have been that will. I mean, it's a bit like the conversation about why isn't there a training ground sponsor? Why don't Newcastle have these, why don't Newcastle have a ready marketplace for players in Saudi? And the answer is they're not being done huge favours. Now, having said all that, down the line, Newcastle do have relationships with Saudi companies, whether it's Seller, whether it's others.
Yeah,
but it has to work for both companies. It has to make sense for those companies as well. And I think that's been something that people just haven't kind of quite got to grips with a bit. That's not to say that PIF wouldn't be willing to invest more money in the team, for example, if they could do it through the regulations. Yeah. I'm not saying that they wouldn't do it. It's just never been part of the regulations allowing them to.
Arthur's asked, is it true that the Saudis have an allocated budget for Newcastle and won't budge on it?
In some ways, that's the same question. They're one of the richest institutions in the world. They can't spend what they have on Newcastle. Now, that's one thing. The second thing has been to say, again, from day one, there's been this suggestion that what they're interested in doing it is making an investment in Newcastle, and ultimately that Newcastle will be worth more money to them if and when they ever sell than when they bought it. Now, that's already taken place. They've spent a lot of money,
but
Newcastle is worth a lot more money. But it hasn't felt, I mean, again, in part because of the restrictions that are in place, it's never felt like LIV Golf. It's never felt like the boxing, where they have just thrown money in creating something new and seeing how much of it sticks. It's just never felt like this. It's always been said, Amanda Staveley talked from day one, this has been run as a business. It's got to wipe its nose, you know.
Yeah.
And again, in partly, that's because of the restrictions that are in place on Newcastle. There is an allocated budget in Newcastle, and it's PSR. I mean, that's what it is. They can't pump money in. But I've never heard that, for example, they're only prepared to spend £100 million a season on other stuff. I've never heard that. I don't know if Chris has.
No, I haven't. And the thing is, we would love to be able to ask these questions to people at PIF, but they're not readily necessarily available to ask those sort of questions to.
We have had a question about the women's team. When does Grace Williams start work?
Yeah, so that was reported on The Athletic. My colleague Matt Woosnam and I report this. My understanding is she has a period of leave similar to, well, notice period essentially, which is a matter of months. So I think that it could be back towards the back end of the summer, unless Newcastle decide to sort of negotiate a deal to get her out earlier. I don't know if they are trying to do that or not, but she is very much coming in. People are still talking about that behind the scenes, despite the fact that obviously Paul Mitchell, who is the person who's appointed there, is going. Grace Williams is coming in to oversee the women's side of the club.
Right then, chaps, let's leave it there. It's been a bit of an epic show, this one. Unlike Bruno, Sandro, Big Dan Byrne, Anthony Gordon and Tino Livramento, we're definitely going to be having a week off, maybe even 2 weeks off. But we will return with a show for you if anything significant happens, I'm sure. We've got a message from Tim that we have to quickly read through. My wife, daughter and I are making our first trip to the UK from the States, and I'm forcing them to stop for a couple of days in Newcastle. Forcing them. I'm not sure about the word in there. Are there any hidden gems we should visit while in the city? Thanks, Tim. Hidden gems. Newcastle hidden gems. Chaps, what have we got on our radar?
Well, these are all places that we've probably talked about before. If you want to have a pint, I would, and you kind of want a real feeling of Newcastle, I'd recommend the Free Trade. Sit outside, look back across. You could get the best view in Newcastle up the river. You'll see St James's from there. The Crown Passada is a great old boozer in the middle of town with the Tyne Bridge sort of right next to you. But there's loads of great pubs.
The Strawberry, of course.
The Strawberry, of course. Yeah, I mean, too many good pubs. Broadchair, go and get some beautiful pub food there. Have a great pint of Writer's Block.
Chris, any butchers you want to recommend?
Well, there are some in the Granger Market. I was going to say, definitely get yourself along to the Granger Market to experience that. I mean, there are so many wonderful, particularly independent businesses in the centre of Newcastle, but also in the suburbs, sort of, if you go Jesmond or Gosforth or Heaton. So I wouldn't just want to name a few because I don't want to miss them out, but I very much echo what George has said. Get yourself along to as many independent places you can, because there's some wonderful ones operating in Newcastle.
They have got a child with them as well, so is there anything we could recommend for children?
No, absolutely not, no.
Well, there's Leeser's Park, the Exhibition Park's very, very good. So if you want to take, obviously, green space along the Saltwell Park, if you want to go down to Gateshead, that's also very, very good. Beamish, I was going to actually mention Beamish, and this is good. We've mentioned it, not in Newcastle, but just not too far away from it. I was there yesterday and bumped into quite a few people who were very complimentary about the podcast. Nice. So that was nice to hear, including one Dan Jackson.
Lovely bloke.
Wrote the Northumbrians and is a prominent Newcastle United fan. And he actually was fully dressed in old-style Beamish regalia. So Beamish is the living museum of the North, for those who
or, don't know. Or regalia, as it's pronounced regalia. In the human language. Yeah.
The human language. And but because Beamish is nominated for being one of the museums of the year, and there was a panel visiting yesterday, and Dan Jackson has a connection with the museum, and so was dressed up, and I was there in shorts and a t-shirt, and he was dressed up in an 1800 style suit. I think it was it. You'll tell me that I've put the incorrect date as to what his actual outfit was, but there you go.
And a neat bit of crossover back to my recommendations, which were only pubs. There is a pub at Beamish Museum. There is. And I have got pissed in that pub.
Good Lord.
That's not true, but I did have 3 pints. I did want to get pissed. I thought that would be quite good to get pissed in a museum.
Let's not suggest that to a family travelling from the States for the first time.
That's too late.
We've also got to say, keep going, Mark Allison as well, our friend Run Geordie Run, currently running coast to coast across the USA. We've got some numbers here. Let's see if any of us think we could achieve anything close to this. He ran 25 miles on Tuesday the 10th of June. I don't think I've run 25 miles in the last 6 months. His average pace, 2.8 miles an hour. He's burned 3,220 calories in a day.
I mean, I've done a marathon. I've done 5 marathons. So I have run 25 miles in a day.
They're called Snickers now, George.
But the point is that Mark is running 100 marathons or more every day, and often significantly more.
He's taken more than 230,000 steps so far in his run.
That's 2,307,456.
That's insane.
Oh, no, sorry, yes. Sorry, I put the decimal point in the wrong place.
Unbelievable stuff.
He's an incredible man. Yeah, he's raising money. I'm sure everyone knows he's raising money for St. Benedict's Hospice. He's an incredible guy. Yeah, Mark, if you're listening, keep it going, son, and we need to get you back on the pod soon. So we need to have a proper chat with you while you're running.
Yes.
Yes, maybe he can regale us with some tales of the States.
Regale us with some regalia.
Right then, that's it. Pod on the tine at theathletic.com if you've got anything you want to say. That's it from us. Thanks very much, chaps, for your time. Cheers, Chris.
You're very welcome. Yes, it was a bit of an epic, but and I know that we haven't necessarily provided the definitive answers as to who Newcastle are going to sign and when they're going to sign them, but I do think providing the context of the situation that Newcastle are in right now and where things are and going to it in this sort of different way, I think there's some very good questions there, and hopefully we've at least provided some indication of the thinking inside the club there.
Personally, I'm more in the dark now than I was when we started this show, but that's probably just me. Thank you very much, George Colgan.
Yes, thank you for some great questions. Really appreciate that. And it's quite fun to do a specialist show on a single subject like that. So, yeah, thanks a lot.
Lovely stuff. Right, that's it from us. Thank you very much for listening. We shall speak to you very soon. It may be a week. It might be 2 weeks, but we will be back. Thank you very much from everybody at Pod on the Tyne. Have a great week. Take care. Goodbye.
The Athletic FC Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, football fans. Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.